Are you looking how to maybe start out your new company or scale your business? Well, tune in this episode to learn how someone went from scratch to a seven-figure land investor. Here next. Hi there once again, everyone, and thank you for joining us for another installment of the IRA Cafe powered by American IRA. I am Kyle Moody in the business development department here, and we are so glad that you have joined us wherever and whenever you may be listening to this podcast. Today, we do have a special guest with us on this episode. Clay Hepler with Landman LLC is using his investments in land, and I don't want this to be, people say, well, somebody that's investing in just the dirt. What about the glamorous real estate, the houses, the buildings, the commercial properties, and this and that? To say he is in the land space or just a land flipper does not even begin to give you the picture of who he is. For the now, he is a coach, but a seven-figure land investor, a podcaster. He hits all the social media platforms, but it's where he came from that can really speak to someone who's listening today, who's thinking about either getting into land investing or, quite honestly, any investing at all. And so if you are wondering out there if this is for you, what's next, then I think you're going to glean a lot of great information from Clay. So Clay, welcome. We're so glad that you're with us today, and I'm going to let you take over the rest of your introduction. We're looking forward to hearing a little bit about you, spend some time on your background and where you've gotten to where you are now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again. I was on the IRA webinar last week, and that was a lot of fun spending that time with you, Kyle. So it's going to be fun to have another session with you here. So, I mean, you know, it's funny. A lot of times you hear the stories of people that are getting into real estate investing, and they talk about, hey, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, or I saw an Instagram ad. That's very common. And it's funny, because all of these were pretty positive experiences, right? They were looking for something. They found it in a book. And for me, it was kind of the opposite, right? I had to get into this because of a necessity. I had to get into this because I had no choice. So long story short, I was in the house wholesaling and flipping business, had flipped hundreds of homes. I was owning rental property, real estate rental property, in the local city that I was living in, which is Pittsburgh. And I purchased over 65 units in less than a year. And these are all much older buildings, Kyle. So, you know, think about 1900 builds, sandstone foundations. You know, most of them are brick buildings. They had plaster and lath instead of drywall. They had knob and tube. They had terracotta sewer line, old breaker boxes, old boiler systems, not even ductwork. And we acquired these properties impressively quickly. But what wasn't impressive was our ability to manage them. And so pretty soon we were purchasing these properties at a time that the BRRRR model was still incredibly feasible. So we were purchasing the properties with hard money and private money, refinancing them, and then putting them on longer term notes, and then, you know, doing the buy, rent, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. And we were able to do that very quickly. But you know, we were renovating them based on a lot of aesthetics. We were doing some large capital expenditures, but not too many. And I was just inexperienced. I was a young investor who was all hat, no cattle, right? All energy, vinegar and some other stuff, right? And we acquired these properties really quickly. And what ended up happening was, I realized that managing the asset is more important than the buying of the asset. Now, a lot of people say, hey, you make your money when you buy. And that's true, right? You got to get it for a good price. But I found that making money really came down to managing money, managing the asset. And we had some bad experiences with property managers. We didn't properly allocate the funds needed for capital expenditures, all while rents were decreasing and interest rates were increasing. So it was a tsunami of bad things happening, right, at the same time. And to make matters worse, right when that was happening, my wife still had her full-time job. I was doing full-time rental property investing and flipping and wholesaling here and there. And my wife lost her job. This was the day before Thanksgiving, almost 3 years ago at this point. And, you know, we had this income stream that was keeping us alive and also kind of keeping us, the reality at bay of our lack of cash flow of this portfolio. And so, man, I got a call from my wife and she was at the gym. I remember my wife doesn't call people at the gym. She's in the gym, she's working out, and she was crying. And it was the middle of the day. And I said, you know, what happened? What's going on? And her company went under. And then I quickly started to look over our personal finances and realized there was a little bit of a different picture than what I saw, right? I was all emotion, no data. I was saying we were acquiring these properties, but not managing these properties. And so when I looked at the data, I realized, dude, I need to make some money really quickly. And so I went and tried to find something that I could do that I had a skill set in that I already knew and understood, which was real estate. But I realized that I wasn't a rental real estate investor and it takes a long time to build wealth with rental. So I need to flip something. I need to create quick cash. And so that's how I found land investing. I was like, hey, I believe this is going to allow me to create quick cash. We, at that point, were planning on moving out to Colorado. And so I needed to make that money. I needed to pay for my wedding. I needed to pay for my life. And so that's how I got into land investing. It wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. It was like, I need to make money quickly or the walls were going to cave in.
So touching on that right there, and that picture on the right that's scrolling by there, you weren't married yet. So there was so much, personal and soon to be even more personal stuff riding on this. I mean, you almost thought you were going to have to cancel the whole thing and just kind of get to it when you could. So like you said, you dove in, used your sense of investing, at least in the real estate world, and hey, what's next? So tell us, why land though? Was it because you saw what happened with the actual dwellings and how you may have lost what you thought was losing control on that? But what made the land so attractive?
Yeah. I would say it was a combination of what now I can see is a simple process, a scalable model, and a sustainable model, right? So, but then the words that I knew to describe what it was, I don't have to deal with tenants. I don't have to deal with termites. I don't have to deal with toilets. And those were all the things that ended up being my Achilles heel in the rental property business. In addition, we were planning on moving at that point out to Colorado. We had a home out in Colorado, which was an Airbnb, another really bad choice. I made it quite a few really bad choices. And we bought this property and we're like, hey, this business needs to be remote. And so naturally, I needed to figure out a business that would allow me to purchase these properties virtually. And I, at that point, had a fixed mindset around flipping houses and owning rental properties virtually because I had done it all in this city that I lived in. And so the approach, the decision making was, look, I have to do this virtually. Number two, I need to make quick cash. And so logically, I thought, like, I don't want to go into a red ocean in land investing. How many people do you know it's sitting in a RIA or a real estate investor conference or talking about land? Yeah, people might be talking about it, flipping houses. A lot of people are wholesaling. A lot of people own rental properties. But how many people are actually buying and selling land? Much fewer than you hear. I mean, you probably know on this podcast. And so I wanted to get into something that I would have a competitive advantage because of my background. And so that's why I realized, hey, land investing was this blue ocean of opportunity that, frankly, Kyle, I just knew that there was a lot of people that weren't in it. And I wanted to capitalize on that quickly.
All right, gotcha. No, and folks, if you didn't catch what I said at the very beginning, and if you didn't catch the timeline that we're talking about here, this isn't something that started 15 years ago. Clay just told you that almost 3 years ago is when his not even wife at the moment, and they were planning their wedding, lost her job. He went in and started looking at the books and figuring out, okay, this is not what I thought. How many of you out there are tracking with this right now? And then track with this, that again, not quite 3 years later, here he is, a seven-figure land investor. So you started from scratch on this 3 years ago. Tell us about the company briefly. We've got some things we want to kind of, you know, really delve into here about how you do what you do. But tell us about your staff and your company and productivity not quite 3 years later, Clay.
For sure. And you're referring to what does my team look like today?
Yeah, absolutely. What have you built that in 3 years? What have you built the company into?
So we have a COO. The COO is ex-Army Special Forces, has his MBA from University of North Carolina. Really, really smart guy, incredibly accomplished, and obviously a leader, a really good leader. So he's our COO. He's my right-hand guy and incredibly, incredibly good at what he does, right? I have a chief of staff who is a chief of staff. She had previously ran a 600-person, second-in-command 600-person tech startup in Cape Town, South Africa. She is South African. So she's chief of staff. She helps with HR. She helps with like QuickBooks, bookkeeping, things like that, taxes, payments, a lot of stuff that a chief of staff would manage. And then if we're looking at the business on the acquisition side, on the front end, we have two lead managers, right? Basically setters on the front end. We have an acquisition manager, and he's making about 25 to 30 offers per week. That is the sales department. So three total people full-time in the sales department. Then we have our marketing department, which has a marketing manager, someone that manages our data, someone that manages our lists. And then we have another six people that are in outbound or different types of capacity underneath him for finding opportunities. I did forget that in our acquisition department, we have a full-time underwriter. He is has his master's degree from University of Michigan in real estate and urban and planning design. Really, really smart guy. He's a project manager as well for our development projects. And so that's kind of front end of the funnel. And then we have a little bit of a data department, a data scrubber, an admin VA underneath our marketer as well. And then visually on the back end of the funnel, we have our transaction coordinator. Then we have a dispositions team, people that help us actually sell our deal. And so we have a disposition associate. You can think about it as a salesperson on the back end selling our deals that we list internally. We have a disposition administrator who is helping us list properties internally. And then we have a disposition manager, right, on that back end. And that's really the structure of the team currently. I don't know how many people that is total, but and then we obviously have on our just general business, we have another four people in our social department that helps us with optimizing listings and getting also social media stuff out there for our funding private equity arm and our regular consulting and helping people build this business.
Less than 3 years, folks. Less than 3 years, and just think about what he's grown. Tell us a little bit about the day to day, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because for those of you who haven't seen the webinar yet, feel free to check that out on our YouTube channel and look at the webinar that we had Clay on last week doing. You'll be able to see that, and you'll see a lot. He's got his slides that really talks about his business, and this was really cool for folks who are looking to see how to do this. But that day to day, Clay, tell us a little bit of how you find your properties.
Sure. So I kind of bucket things like our marketing in three sort of buckets. We have inbound, we have outbound, and then we have free. And so you can think about, we first look in certain areas that have an indication, for example, of a velocity, a sale velocity, right? Land is an illiquid asset unless you find markets in which it's liquid. So we spend a lot of time on the front end finding markets through, you know, obviously I did this on the webinar, but a series of very kind of relatively basic and straightforward processes around using sell-through rates and days on markets to indicate the health and velocity of a market. We target those market through outbound, which is reaching out directly to seller, whether it's through cold calling or any other outbound sources. We'll do inbound, which is we'll do a mixture of sometimes pay-per-click, sometimes direct mail, and then we'll do free, which is we have relationships with brokers and other free resource, you know, free channels to bring deals into our business for us to acquire. And then, you know, we get these deals under contract. Like, you normally would get a house deal under contract. So a lot of people will send us deals and they want us to partner and consult with them and helping them actually take down these larger deals or development deals. We do a bunch of development deals as well. So that's kind of the way that we acquire these opportunities.
No, that's really good. And one of the, you actually touched on one of the things about people are coming to you asking about partnering. When you were looking for your land acquisition, let's say, depending on the size, is that something that you're doing 100%? Is it something that you are also looking for partnering? Is it, you know, any syndication deals that go in that you look at? And the follow-up to that is, you know, talk to us what it would be like if you did have an offering. You know, something is out there as an LLC. You've got a lot of LPs getting in on the deal. And so there are folks, some of our listeners are thinking, hey, I'd like to use my self-directed retirement account to possibly do get in on one of these syndication investments like that. Talk a little bit about that, what it would be like for someone to make an investment like that with you.
Yep. So, I mean, we look at every, we do raise capital. We're closing about $4 million, $5 million of transactions over the next 45 days. It is our most amount that we've ever closed. We're closing like six deals this week. I actually just got off the phone this morning with the guy that we raised a little bit over $450,000 for to place in a couple of deals. You know, example of a deal, Kyle, would be we're purchasing this property in Dallas, southwest of Dallas. It is a multifamily zone, multifamily parcel. We're purchasing it for $255,000, and we believe we'll sell it close to about $550,000 under 6 months. So that's not our normal kind of deal, to be honest with you. Our normal deal is a buy for 60, sell for 120, buy for 50, sell for 100. Those are a lot of our bread and butter. But as we're becoming more of an expert in development, we are actually raising capital. So it depends on the deal for what we offer our investors, but they're incredibly attractive returns. They're much more attractive than if you were a private lender, for example. You know, I know private lenders might get 8% and maybe a point or 10%. We do offer pretty good terms as it relates to the smaller check sizes that we have.
So it sounds too that you have people coming to you, and it might not always be about the land. Tell us a little bit about the different facets of the business and what it's grown into. In other words, do you do things? We know that you started a few years ago in the real estate. Has that crept back in? So do you do anything other than just the land now?
You know, it's like going to a therapist. It takes a long time to get over a bad experience, right? No, we you know, I say that kind of jokingly, but at this point, we're primarily in just land investing and development. We have not gone vertical yet. Does that mean we won't go vertical? Does that mean we're not going to add additional exit strategies? No, the way I think about our firm and in general is we are chasing the highest and best yield on land. And so whether that means we're buying it and flipping it, we are wholesaling it, whether that means we are partnering and being a co-investor or joint venture partner with another person, whether that means us re-entitling or rezoning the land for the highest and best use. That is our MO. So our business is, because we can do so much with a piece of land, like you can only really do so much with an apartment building. At this point, our expertise is in the dirt and not in the development of the dirt, development as in, you know, shovels in ground. And so we keep it pretty minor in the development because we have such plethora of exit strategies. We don't really want to, at this point, blend the amount of things that we offer our investors and ourselves.
Let's talk about the folks who are listening to us today. And you know, they, like we talked about at the top of the show, they are where you were. They may be in a worse situation. They may even be in a better situation, but they feel like they are poised to now take this step. Whether it's stepping away from the 9-to-5, they want to make this their full time. So whether it's someone in your space or someone looking to get into your space, what do they need to know to start? I mean, how much money might they need to have in the bank to get ready to make this leap? Some pitfalls that you could caution people that, hey, maybe if you knew this going in, what can somebody really take away from this today, Clay?
That's a really good question. And I would say that expectation setting is very important when you get into any business. And so I would analogize it to, like, you wouldn't expect to get your degree in under 4 years. It's really hard to get your degree in under 4 years. Now, I would say I have had I've had an experience in my business that is atypical in terms of the amount of scale that we've been able to hit quickly, but that's because of my background and understanding. And so if you don't really have that much experience in entrepreneurship, I wouldn't expect you to replicate a multi 7-figure business in 3 years. But most people are just chasing what I call the ideal land business, which is making between $500,000 to $1.5 million in a year gross profit and 40 to 50% margin. So you're taking home anywhere between $200,000 to $750,000-ish. For a lot of people, that's really great. So I think that building the business is the most, building the type of business you want to build is the most important. So, you know, you hear people are talking about, hey, this is the greatest. Land investing is the greatest. Airbnb investing is the greatest. Burr investing is the greatest. There's all trade-offs of everything that you do. And I think that it's very important when you get in any business venture is to understand what is the actual goal? What is the outcome here that I'm optimizing for? And so the outcome that I believe for a lot of people is that ideal business and building an actual business, not a prison. So people will come in, Kyle, and they'll be really, really excited and they'll go super fast for 3 months and they'll do it at an unsustainable pace and then they will fall down. Right? They will not be able to build a sustainable, scalable business. And I would say for me, one of the reasons why I was successful is, you know, I knew that consistency outplayed just blunt attacking of the problem. So I had an expectation for this is how much I wanted to make in my first year. And I built the business around that. I had a very clear goal and I was forced to have that because I had to, right? I had to actually pay for my wedding and I had to pay for my life. And so I had to really force myself to be really clear on what I needed out of the business. So if you're going to start this business or any venture in general, you want to be really clear, KYG, know your goal, right? Exactly what by exactly when and who's going to be accountable to that. And then you can build a business in order to hit that, right? And how much money you need to start, that was your next question. It really depends on how much money you want to make out of this business. So if you start with $100,000, your probability of hitting a multi six-figure profit business is going to be quite high, right? In your first year, right? It's hard for me to see someone not being able to do that. But I would say you want to start with a minimum of, at this point, probably $15,000 to $20,000 so that you can have consistency over a period of 6 months. And that should get you a, probably a couple of deals, depending on the marketing channel that you use. And then you can recalibrate after those 6 months and go from there. That's not including any sort of education. If you want to have education, I mean, YouTube University is incredible. You can learn a lot through that.
Did you start out by yourself or any of your team that's with you now? Were they with you 3 years ago?
None of them were. I started out by myself.
Wow. Okay. So that's what leads me into this. And there's people that are shaking their heads and going, okay. And this is where I think that the gut check comes in for a lot of folks, because you said it, results aren't typical. And, you know, just because one person can do it doesn't mean that everyone else can. What set Clay apart then? Was it the desperation? Was it the necessity? You had nowhere else to go but locking in on this and going up. You set the expectation, but what set you apart then? And is that anything different that sets your entire team apart now?
Really good question. My response to that is that when you are forced to focus on revenue driving activities, your business grows.
Sure, yeah.
And I had to do the right things, right? I had to produce revenue. I had to talk to people. I had to focus on improving my marketing. Kyle, it wasn't like I was just sitting there and like waiting for life to hit me. I had to hit life. I had to scale this business. So the constraint of I need to make money caused me at a very high level to focus on the right activities. I would say something like this. Imagine you get a analysis from a doctor, and the doctor says to you, you know what, you have a really bad heart condition, and if you don't get healthy, you're overweight, you're eating poorly, if you don't get healthy, you're going to die in 6 months. You'd be like, dude, I'm running home, right? I'm eating well. I'm focusing on everything that I need to do in order to be successful. And so it's like the Cortez burning of the ships, right? There is so much focus that comes with the looming deadline of I'm going to go under that I was forced to do that. Now, the question that you asked is, how do you replicate that, I presume, in your modern day team, right? How do you keep that hunger, that focus? It comes down to the culture of the team. And the culture comes from the CEO. And so, you know, if your business is not performing up to what your expectation is, there's no one else to blame but you. So, right? Like, it's your business, or if your department, if you're in a business context, your department is not performing. It's not about Jimmy or Sarah. It's about you. And so taking accountability of like, this is my business, man. Like, I need to take ownership of this. And I think people want to scale out of their business too soon. I think people want to delegate tasks that are not, quote unquote, their responsibility, not scalable. But the reason why I was successful is because focusing on revenue producing activities and focusing on tasks that weren't necessarily scalable because I had to.
Gotcha. Couple more things here. We could probably build these in together for anybody who saw the webinar. I believe we may have touched on this, but anytime someone is in, you know, turning deals, and anytime you're in networking groups and you're there with folks who are lifers in the game, they'll tell you things that Clay actually just said earlier, and he will probably be the first person to tell you. I think he alluded it to it a few minutes ago. That it's not what always went right that he learned the most from, but it was some of the mistakes he made. And that's where the most learning happens. Give us an example of one of your deals that you learned the most from.
This would have been my second year. We purchased this property in Williamson County, Tennessee. And Williamson County, for those that don't know, is the highest income county in the state of Tennessee. It's directly south of Nashville. Really, really beautiful county. We bought this amazing lot, infill lot. It's about 5 acres, a little less than 5 acres. And we thought it was going to sell for probably $500,000, maybe even 600K. I forget what the numbers we were projecting. And we got it under contract for $180,000. I trusted someone else's recommendation for a real estate broker. That I knew, someone that I knew, lived in this county, and recommended this broker. This broker said that they walked the parcel, and they also said that we did perk this lot, which for those that don't know, perking is a percolation test. It basically tests whether or not a soil is viable for a septic tank in an area where there's no sewer line. So a septic tank would be where the household waste would go to. So we perked it. It did not perk, but this guy basically said, hey, you can use an engineered system, which is basically a much more expensive system to put a septic tank in. So you'll be totally fine, right? So we get this thing under contract. Like very soon we get an amazing offer on it and they do their due diligence and we find out that in fact what this broker said to me was incorrect. That the percolation test was not viable. It did not perk. And there's no way for us to actually put a septic tank on this land. So I was irate. I was irate. And I raised capital from investors, right? I raised capital and I brought capital to myself, to the pay, to the table. And we also found out that the broker actually never walked the parcel. And there's a meth lab on the parcel with literally meth barrels, like the big, there's big plastic barrels that you see, the literal meth barrels on the, in the parcel, right at the back of the parcel. So we had an actively in use meth laboratory, and that was probably worth more than the land at this point. And then we had a parcel of land that was not perkable. And the thing with the land, it was so beautiful. It went on this top of this hill, and this hill overlooked this, like basically downtown Nashville. But the reality was, man, we couldn't put anything on it. And so we kept dropping the price. We kept dropping. And then finally we offered owner financing at like 3 or 4 points below bank rates at a 30-year loan. And like a 10-year amortization to try to sell it to someone. Someone bought it. I don't know what they did with it, but then we sold that.
I was going to ask you. Yeah, I was going to ask you. Well, what's that buyer going to use
it for? I didn't ask. I was like, let's just get this thing to closing. You know what I mean? So I didn't ask. I was like, just close it, right? And so we closed it, and eventually we sold this mortgage. And for those, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that people can buy mortgages at a discounted rate and they're looking for yield. So you might originate a mortgage that's worth $200,000 and the yield on the mortgage is basically the relationship of the yield is how much you pay for it versus how much you get paid over time to get your capital back, essentially, right? And so we sold this mortgage at like less, like 50% of its value because it was so worthless for the investor to get their yield. And so I did come to the table with over $60,000 to make my investors whole. I basically sold it for the same number that I bought it for. And that took about 18 months. But, you know, the lessons learned there was triple check due diligence. You know, you have to triple check with brokers and other vendors that are giving you values, right? And the number three is, you know, make your investors whole. No matter what, right? The investors that I eventually had to pay off, I did pay off. I made them whole. They've kept investing with me to this very day. So, I've never investors have never lost money on a deal that they've invested with me with. But I had to write over $60,000 check to make those guys whole.
Trust but verify. Take care of your investors, and I've got to think that there are folks out there right now that maybe what we need to do sometime is have a webinar or a podcast with all of the horror stories, because it's actually what people learn from that. Maybe that's, well, I don't know if that'd be a good thing for folks getting into the gig to hear or not, but the flip side is truth and jest that, you know, that's knowledge that, hey, it's not always maybe what you want to hear, but things that you need to know. Well, listen, Clay, we've really enjoyed the time today. Thanks so much for joining us again. For those of you out there who have not had the chance yet to see Clay's webinar that he did with us, you can definitely go catch that on our YouTube channel. And then also anyone on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, like us on any of those and start getting some of our information dropped into your feeds from there. You can also access all of us at American IRA at AmericanIRA.com. There we have all of our educational pieces, information on the different account types, the asset classes, and how everything can be used so that you can meet your investment objectives. So again, one last time, on behalf of Clay Hepler, the Landman LLC, and just a phenomenal guest, a phenomenal webinar host, and really a phenomenal businessman, that if you ever want to try to get in touch with Clay, I think we do have some information that he can get out there to you. If you ever are looking to do some investing, remember, you can do every single bit of this with your self-directed IRA. If you have any questions on setting up that account, I am more than available to speak with you. You can call me directly, 828-412-8123. And we also look forward to any of our returning clients that we take care of you day in and day out. So for everyone at American IRA, I'm Kyle Moody here with another episode of the IRA Cafe powered by American IRA. Thanks again. We'll see you again soon.
American IRA LLC, a North Carolina LLC, acts as a third-party administrator for New Vision Trust Company, a state-chartered South Dakota trust company. As a neutral self-directed IRA administrator, American IRA does not recommend or endorse any investments, individuals, or entities, including financial representatives, promoters, or companies. American IRA and the IRA Cafe are not responsible for other statements, representations, or agreements, nor do we evaluate the quality or profitability of any investment. American IRA does not endorse guests on the IRA Cafe podcast. Guest opinions are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of American IRA, its subsidiaries, associates, or custodian. Participation in the podcast is voluntary and no compensation is provided. American IRA is not a fiduciary and cannot offer financial advice. Please consult your CPA or another professional before making financial decisions.